You know, this is the second time we've played the same trick. Use the blast to hide what we really meant. The data center. Now the missing power armor they'll all think is out there in the black. If they think we have it, they'll change the shutdown code before we can reverse engineer it. I know why, Cutria said. I'm saying don't count on doing it again. Patterns get people like you and me killed. This strategy is played out. If Saba thinks otherwise, he's a fool. Bobby popped the wheels on the transport cart out, extended the handle. It rolled easily. She wasn't looking forward to pushing the damn thing through the public areas of the station to Saba's rendezvous, but she also wanted to get out of here as quickly as she could. She forced herself to take one long, slow look at it before she opened the doors, though, in case there was blood on it. "There won't be a third time," she said. "You're sure of that?" Cutria asked. "Positive," Bobby said. "You get your people, and you tell them to be ready. Cracking the code in this suit is the trigger. 2 minutes after that happens, we're all getting the hell off this station." Chapter 45. Drummer. Bright green dots were blinking out. Not all at once, but enough to notice. A wave of darkness moving through the cloud of attacking ships. Drummer checked the timestamp, but there was no gap. Whatever the Tempest had done at Palace, it still hadn't repeated here. So what the hell was going on? "Is it the Tempest? Is it firing?" "Yes, ma'am," the sensors tech said. "The missiles are coming from the Tempest, yes." "How fucking many of them?" The cloud of green, the orange dot, and now a new form. Red threads blooming out from the enemy, thick and ropey as a capillary map. The ship itself was lost in them. They reached out toward the EMC vessels, the Union fighters, the void cities. "That isn't possible. That's wrong," Drummer said. The Tempest hadn't resupplied since it had come through the ring gate. It had been in a major engagement already. There was no way for what she was looking at to be real. "The data is confirmed," the sensor tech said. "Guard of Passage is reporting the same thing." "Get me Cameron Tour," she said. "Or Laughlin." Anyone who might be able to make the incomprehensible make sense. "Should I continue to fire?" the weapons tech asked. "Are we still in a fucking fight? Then yes, you should keep firing." Vaughn made a small, disapproving sound in his throat, but she was far past caring about the delicacy of his sensibilities. The red threads swam through the void. They only seemed slow on the display, because the distances were so vast. Here and there, a thread died. A PDC round or a missile destroying the Tempest's attack. But there were so many, and when even one slipped past the guard, another green dot blinked out. The green dots shifted, swirling in the display as the ships did in the darkness. A few dove toward the Tempest, moving almost at the same speed as the torpedoes. As gentle as it looked on the display, it was a killing burn. A suicide run for the crews of every ship that did it. More followed suit, until dozens of ships were driving down toward the enemy. It was a tactic of unspeakable bravery and desperation. Drummer didn't notice that her hands were in fists until the ache caught her attention. She made her fingers open, looked at the little flaps of skin she'd carved off with her nails. The suicide attack reached its peak. It reminded her of pictures she'd seen of cloudbursts over the deserts of Earth, huge, angry clouds with numberless tentacles of gray falling from them. A torrent of water racing toward a parched landscape and evaporating again before a drop could darken the soil. On the visual display, the bright, dancing veins on the Tempest were fading, and now that she knew to look, Drummer could see tiny openings along the sides of the ship, opening and closing like pores. The lights of the missile's drive plumes were like blue fireflies. "How can they do that?" she whispered past the tightness in her throat. "I have Cameron Tour," the communications tech said. The camera made his face even longer than it seemed in person. The light shone in his eyes. "Where the fuck are you?" Drummer snapped. "Are you seeing this?" There was almost no lag before he answered. He was close then, one of the escape ships. "I don't understand. The number of missiles they've fired, that they're firing, these can't be normal devices." On the display, the last three suicide attackers blinked out. If the Tempest moved to avoid the debris fields, it wasn't enough to register at this scale. It looked as though the enemy wasn't even bothering to evade anymore. "The first battle, we wanted to learn from them," Tour said, talking fast and not looking directly at the camera. "I mean, we wanted to win. Of course we wanted to win, but we didn't expect to. The data, how we lost, was as important as stopping them." "Tour, maybe they were learning from us, too. Maybe they recalibrated something about the regrowth of the ship, or the missiles." "They survived a direct nuclear strike," Drummer said. "Are you telling me that's something they can just do?" "Apparently," Tour said. He licked his lips anxiously. "We knew for the moment they stripped the railguns off the ring station that they are capable of focusing and directing incredible sources of power. Things we've only ever seen on celestial levels. Collapsing stars." "Collapsing stars? We're fighting a supernova in the shape of a ship? Why the hell didn't you see this coming?" She was shouting, her throat hurt with it. Tour blinked, and his jaw shifted forward. He would have looked like a man spoiling for a fight if it hadn't been for the tears on his cheeks. She didn't think those tears had anything to do with her raising her voice. "Ma'am, that ship stripped Palace Station down to something less than atoms. It shut down consciousness throughout the system in a way that I don't have the structural language to explain, and it seems pretty fucking unimpressed by the idea of locality. It's affecting the nature of vacuum through the whole solar system. If you didn't know we were punching above our weight here, I'm not sure what I could have said to clarify that." "There is a way to beat them," Drummer said, "and we are running out of time. Find me how to win this, and do it now." She cut the connection before he had the chance to reply. Silence filled the control room. No one was looking straight at her, but she felt their attention like a weight. All the time she'd spent resisting the pressure to make the transport union into a police force, into a military, and here she was anyway. "Mr. Vaughn?"
"Yes, ma'am."
"Find me whoever is in command of the EMC wing of the fleet. I need them now." "Whoever's still alive," she thought, but didn't say.
"Yes, ma'am."
The weapons tech's voice shook. "Should we keep firing?" Drummer said. Drummer felt a heat in her chest, a rage and a certainty. This was the moment that tested everything she'd meant to be. This was what it was to be a leader in a time of crisis. She felt the raw power of it, the raw will to succeed, to devastate and end the people who would destroy her and the system she embodied. She rose to her feet, her hands behind her, and she knew that everyone in the control room who looked at her would see nothing beyond her superhuman resolve. Not even Vaughn. And she knew it for the hollow mask that it was. How fragile. "Guard of Passage is reporting a missile strike that got past their PDCs," Vaughn said. "They're requesting permission to withdraw." "We can't run away," Drummer said. If we break now, people's home shuddered. A sound like the wail of a demon rattled up from the deck, bellied out from the bulkheads, rained from the ceiling. She waited for the wide, low hiss of escaping atmosphere. The fading of screams as the air became too thin to carry them. Instead, klaxons blared. She held her voice as steady as she could. Report? We're hit, the sensor's tech said. Something hit us. Do we know what? Drummer said. Railgun, Vaughn said. Appears to have impacted Section 12, just spinward of the medical facilities. How bad's the damage? I'll let you know as I have reliable information, he said. Still trying to identify the chain of command with the EMC. Which meant they were in disorder. She wondered whether the band of suicide ships had been led by some admiral bent on making their last stand count for something. People's home bucked again, then twice more. Engineering's been hit, Vaughn said. The reactors, I can't tell. Something's wrong with the reactor. If the magnetic bottle failed, it would be like a low-yield nuke going off. Even if it didn't crack the city open like an egg, the systems that kept them all alive would be melted and fused. And the prospect of aid ships reaching them in the chaos of the battle were low enough to pass for never. Drop core, Drummer said. Vaughn didn't reply, but the thrust gravity stopped. Drummer grabbed the edge of her crash couch and dragged herself back into it, strapping down with the ease of a lifetime's habit. The automated emergency report showed long swathes of the city under lockdown, pressure doors isolating levels and halls, keeping the air in the city as best they could. If she hadn't sent away as many non-essential personnel as the ships would hold, it would have been worse. As it was, it still meant deaths. People who'd trusted the union elections to put someone in charge who would protect them. How many of them were dead now, who'd been alive an hour ago? And how many more seconds before the next round came? It was like someone else's thought dropped into her own brain. A sickly calm washed over her. This was what it felt like, to see death. To know that the worst was coming, and there was nothing she could do to turn it aside. Keep firing, she said. If we're going down, let's go down swinging. The weapons tech coughed out something between laughter and despair. We are dry on railgun rounds. We are at 6 conventional plasma torpedoes and 5% on PDC. Fire anyway, Drummer thought. Throw everything at them. Except that if the Tempest threw a missile at them, there would be no defense. Drummer closed her eyes. The temptation was still there. If it meant that she died, that all the men and women under her command died with her, at least it would be over. She wouldn't wake up in a wave of dread. She wouldn't watch the structures she'd sworn to protect be peeled away by a threat she hadn't considered worth thinking about until the Tempest had flown through Laconia Gate. Come on. There has to be a way. Think of it. Find it. Should I maintain fire? The weapons tech asked. Drummer didn't open her eyes. The moment stretched. No, she said. Shift to defensive fire only. We can't shoot down railgun rounds, but we can hold their missiles off. Yes, ma'am, the weapons tech said. She could hear the relief in his voice. She wondered if he would have thrown away the last scrap of protection on her order. And she wondered whether she'd have done it in his position. Maybe. I have a connection to Colonel Massey, Vaughn said. Who? Commander Fernand Massey, of the Arcadia Rose, ma'am. He's in command of the EMC ships. I've never heard his name before, Drummer said. No, ma'am, Vaughn said. All the admirals were dead. All the people she might have known. As ruined as people's home was, the fleet was in tatters. Her tactical display listed the ships disabled or dead. There were so many. A quarter of the combined fleet incapacitated or destroyed. They'd thrown everything at the tempest, a wall of tungsten and explosives, and the enemy was still under thrust, still firing. It had all been a show. She'd known that. The Tempest's intentionally predictable approach to Earth and Mars, letting the EMC and Union prepare themselves. She thought it was just a way to erode their morale, but it was more than that. She saw it now. They'd known that they would win, so they'd invited the enemy to make the strongest showing it could. That way, when victory came, it would be unequivocal.
"Ma'am," Vaughn said.
"Yes, fuck it, fine, I'll talk to him."
"No, ma'am. There's a new message for you. A tight beam from the Tempest. It's listed as command to command."
Something twisted in her gut, part despair and part relief. If they were sending messages, maybe they weren't sending nukes. At least, not until she'd had the chance to hear what they had to say. She undid her restraints and launched herself to a wall handhold. Her crash couch hissed and spun on its gimbals. "Route to my office, please," she said, as if it were a normal message on a normal day, and not the dividing line between living under a conquering boot and dying before the end of shift. Anxious curiosity shone in every expression, even Vaughn's, as she passed. She could have played the message there, in front of all of them. Maybe she should have. Nothing in it would be secret for long, anyway. But she didn't want anyone watching her when she saw it, except Saba, and she wanted him there badly. In her office, she closed the door, then locked it. The little fern in the corner held its fronds high in the null G. A few things she hadn't stowed, a drinking bulb, a printout on plastic flimsy, a clump of potting soil, floated in the air. She'd spent too long in spin gravity. She'd come to assume it would always be there. A few years' habit enough to erase generations of experience and belter identity. She was aware that her brain wasn't functioning normally. She felt more like she was piloting her body than living it. She knew it was shock and trauma, but knowing it changed nothing. She strapped herself into her chair, took control of her personal interface, and opened her pending messages. Three were listed as unread. One was from the commander of one of the refugee ships, one from a captain of one of the EMC ships, and the last was listed as Admiral Anton Trejo of the Laconian Imperial Navy. Somewhere in a different universe, the klaxon stopped their wailing. She wished now that she'd brought Vaughn, at least, and maybe a whiskey. She started the message playback. Trejo sat at his station, his uniform immaculate and pressed. His thinning black hair was in place, and his eyes a bright green. He didn't even have the good taste to look disheveled. His smile radiated warmth and sympathy. She half expected him to start talking to her about his relationship to God or a business opportunity she should keep quiet about for fear of starting a rush. "President Drummer, I hope," he drawled like someone from the Mariner Valley. "If not, then please accept my condolences for her passing. I am Admiral Trejo, of the Laconian battleship Heart of the Tempest, but you knew that. I'm reaching out to you now because I don't want to be misunderstood. Despite all the hostilities the Transport Union and the Earth-Mars Coalition have greeted me with, we're not enemies. Not you and me. Not the Union and the Empire. Not Sol System and Laconia.
The High Council knew that there would be resistance to this change. We all did, and we respect that you had to do the things you've done. When people like you and I enter into a new phase of history, there's, I don't know what you'd call it, birth pangs. There's a time when you have to expect violence, even though you don't celebrate it. When the High Council first explained to me the parameters of this mission, I wasn't pleased. One ship, no backup, against an entire system. But he brought me around. And this moment, this message, is part of why I felt that his approach was the only moral way forward. I have tried to reach Secretary General Lee, but he isn't returning my messages yet. You're here, and you are at least equal in dignity to anyone on the inner planets. You can end this. I understand that you had to fight. You had to try to destroy me. I don't blame you for this, but I am permitted at this point to accept your surrender. Do this, and the inner planets will follow you. You will be treated fairly by the new administration, I promise you that. If you are not yet willing to accept defeat, then I would ask you, out of what I hope is mutual respect, to tell me one thing. What is the number of dead that you need in order to show history that your choice to end this was wisdom? That carrying on the fight would not have been bravery, but foolishness. 100 more, 1,000 more, 1,000,000, 1,000,000,000. Only say how many more corpses will make this possible for you, and I will provide them. He spread his hands. Tell me the number. I await your reply. The message ended. Drummer floated against her restraints and thought about whether to play the message again, if only to give herself a few more moments before she went back to the command center. She could feel her pulse in her throat and in her wrists, a throbbing exhaustion. Released herself, pushed toward the door, down the short hall. They were all silent when she arrived. She looked at her crash couch, there before the display. The moth-eaten wave of green, the tiny, indomitable dot of orange. Vaughn, I'll need you to send a message to the heart of the Tempest. Ma'am, Vaughn said, nodding crisply. I could order him to his death. I could tell them all to fight to the last breath. The message is this. The number is 0. Send that, and then order all Union ships to stand down. She looked for some reaction in Vaughn's face. Rage, or relief, or disappointment. It was like expecting emotions from a stone. Yes, ma'am, he said. Is there anything else? No, she said. There is nothing else. No way forward. Her fight was over. If there was any hope to stand against this empire, it was someplace else now. If. Chapter 46. Sing. He didn't see the catastrophe coming. Even when the scope of it became clear, he struggled to understand it, blindsided. The talk in the station, the talk everywhere, was about Sol's system and the surrender. Singh watched it play out in news feeds and discussion forums, taking the role of official censor more for the joy of being present in the unfolding of history than from any immediate need. The combined fleet of the Transport Union and the EMC beaten and standing down. The news feeds from the local sources in Seoul's system were anguish and despair, with only a few outlets calling unconvincingly for the battle to continue. For their own side, Kerry Fisk and the Laconian Congress of Worlds proved to be an apt tool for the job, praising the Transport Union's capitulation as a moment of liberation for the former colony worlds. The rules and restrictions on trade are no longer being dictated by the generational politics of Sol. By being outside the system of favoritism, nepotism, political horse trading, and compromise, Laconia is positioned to bring exactly the reforms that humanity needs. He noticed that she shied away from mentioning High Consul Duarte's name. It was always just Laconia. Which was fine. The two were essentially the same. But it was the conversation beyond her and other specifically recruited allies that made him feel best. Governor Kwan from Barragan Complex issued a statement of support for the new administration so quickly that Singh was almost certain it had been recorded in advance. Oberon's local parliament also sent a public message to put themselves in place as early supporters of the new regime. New Spain, New Roma, Ningxiaxin, Felicité, Paradiso, Patria, Asylum, Chrysanthemum, Riacht. Major colonies, some with populations already in the millions, had seen the battle at Leuctra Point and drawn the only sane conclusion. The power center of the human race had shifted, and the wise were shifting with it. The imminent arrival of the typhoon also helped. He had known Rear Admiral Song since he'd entered the service. Not that they'd ever been close, but she was a face and a name that carried a weight of familiarity. He'd only traded a handful of messages with her, mostly to arrange the peace for the news feeds, but speaking to her had reminded him powerfully of home. The routines he'd had on Laconia, the taste of the tea, the little park where he would sit with Elsa when she was newborn and Natalia was sleeping, watching sunbirds dive into the pond. Sending James Holden back had begun it, and the coming of the typhoon would complete it. Traffic to and from Laconia, proof that the great roads of space were open. The longing it called forth in him was vast and complex. The open sky that he wouldn't see as long as he remained governor of Medina. The touch of his wife's skin against his, which he could look forward to. His daughter's laughter, and the soft sound she made at the edge of sleep. There was a way in which every day since he'd stepped off the storm had been a pause, like holding his breath. And soon, soon his real work could begin. With the typhoon in place, and Sol's system conquered, the Empire would be unassailable, and humanity's future assured. He'd ignored his own anxiety and impatience, and now that he could almost relax, he felt them straining for that release. Taken together, all the good news nearly made up for the bad. By comparison, the attack was minor, Overstreet said, walking beside him as they went to the executive commissary. We lost two Marines, but the infrastructure damage was trivial compared with the previous attack. Singh wasn't sure whether they had come off the patterned time for the executive staff, or if word had spread before him and cleared the commissary, but only four people were seated at tables enough for 50. The door attendant ushered them to a small table set apart from the rest, where they wouldn't be casually overheard. He and Overstreet made the requests, green tea for Singh, a local drink called Black Castle for Overstreet, before they went on with their conversation. "We have them on the run," Singh said. "Smaller attacks, targets of convenience instead of strategic ones. This underground is running out of steam." "That is certainly possible, sir," Overstreet agreed. Still, I'll feel better when we have them all in custody. It probably wasn't another dig at his decision to send away Holden, but Singh felt a little sting all the same. The drinks arrived with a small plate of pastries. Overstreet held back until Singh had taken one. A small point, but one that Singh appreciated. "What is the status of our friend's operation?" he asked. Overstreet leaned forward, folding his hands around the cup of Black Castle. His mouth narrowed. "We should know in about half an hour now. If your informant is what he claims to be, he and his co-conspirators will be walking into the power routing station. I have 5 officers and 5 Marines waiting for them." "Do you expect a fight?"
"I'm hoping for one," Overstreet said. "There's nothing the troops would like better than an excuse to break a couple heads.
I need those brains intact." "Fingers, then," Overstreet said with a chuckle. "No one loves a mad bomber."
"Fair enough.
The informant, though, he goes free." Overstreet nodded, but he looked like he'd tasted something bitter. Singh leaned in a degree and let the silence ask the question for him. Overstreet met his eyes, looked away, and shrugged.
"I'm not sure that's a good idea, sir. If we take the others and he slips away, his people will know he's working for us. They could turn him back."
Singh felt a stab of annoyance, but he pushed it down. He had to remember what he'd learned with Tanaka. Better that he be patient.
"You think he may be a triple agent? It wouldn't be the first time something like that had happened. The one thing you know about someone who's willing to compromise his allies is that he's willing to compromise his allies."
"What do you suggest?"
"Question him, the same as the others," Overstreet said. "When his trial comes up, put a word in the judge's ear."
Singh sipped his tea. It was still a little too hot. It scalded. "I'm not certain that helps us build a network of locals who will work with us.
If I do my job right, we'll be able to put a replacement in his spot. And a little clemency come sentencing time is more than he deserves."
It felt like a betrayal. The man, compromised though he was, had done his part. He'd brought the information to prevent the sabotage of Medina's sensors to Singh. Handing him over for trial didn't seem like a just reward for loyalty. But Overstreet had a point. Jordao was a member of a conspiracy against the station and Laconia. He likely had blood on his hands. And there was a greater loyalty that a governor owed to his own people than anything a local thug could command.
"Fair enough," Singh said. "A normal interrogation. But tell your people just that. If they need to take the frustrations out on someone, make it the ones who weren't working with us."
"I can do that," Overstreet agreed, and a moment later, "It'll be good having this wrapped up before the typhoon gets here. I was hoping this wouldn't drag on."
"To a degree," Singh said, "it's to be expected. Periods of transition invite a certain..."
Overstreet started. He put his Black Castle down fast enough that it sloshed onto the table, then he checked the monitor on his wrist. The red of a priority alert glowed there like a little flame. He tapped it with a scowl. His eyes went dead. Singh's breath went shallow. Something had happened. Another terrorist attack.
"What is it?" Singh asked. "We have an unauthorized launch," Overstreet said, standing up.
Singh stood with him, drinks and baked goods forgotten. Adrenaline surged through him. A ship, even a small one, crashing into Medina could do terrible damage, could crack the drum, destroy the station. Overstreet was already walking for the security station, fast, scissoring steps that weren't quite running and weren't quite anything else. Singh had to trot to catch up.
"What ship?"
Singh asked. Old Martian gunship, Overstreet said. Name's the Rosinante.
James Holden's ship.
What did that mean? Was his crew making some kind of doomed bid to catch the Lightbreaker and bring him back? Or take revenge for his loss?
It has capacity for 20 missiles and a keel-mounted railgun, not to mention a fusion drive that could melt the station to slag if it chose to, Overstreet said. But it hasn't opened fire. It's staying close to the station with maneuvering thrusters.
Can we take them out?
We destroyed Medina's defenses when we took it, Overstreet said. We have a few that were repairable, but without the supplies from the typhoon, our abilities are limited.
The storm, then, Singh said.
Overstreet took a deep breath, turning smartly at the intersection. Surprise and anxiety made the security office seem kilometers away.
I don't like the idea of having a close-quarters battle between those ships right near the station. If the Rosinante is just trying to escape, there's an argument for letting it go.
We can't rely on the enemy's goodwill to protect us, Singh said, and opened a priority connection to the storm.
Commander Davenport, his executive officer on the journey out, answered like he'd been waiting.
Davenport, this is Governor Singh. I am formally instructing you to leave dock immediately and protect the station from the gunship Rosinante.
Yes, sir,
Davenport said, then hesitated.
We are presently at less than full crew, sir.
A little short-staffed now is better than a full ship too late. Try to chase them away from the station before you engage.
Yes, sir, he said, and he dropped the connection.
Ahead of them, security was clearing the corridor.
An emergency alert sounded, and a gentle voice began.
This is an emergency alert. Report to shelters immediately and await official instructions. This is an emergency alert.
The security center was buzzing like a kicked hive. Voices raised in alarm thickened the air. The feeds from drones and surveillance cameras filled every screen.
Singh assumed it was all in response to the Rosinante's launch, until an older woman in security uniform barked at them.
Major Overstreet, sir, we have reports of a riot in the detention cells.
What? Singh said. Overstreet's voice was level and calm, like a pilot whose ship was coming to pieces around him.
What do we know?
Someone overrode the containment on the cells. There was some kind of explosion. The guards have retreated to the security lock, but I'm getting reports of gunfire from the civilian side, too. I have two fire teams on their way.
Good, Overstreet said. He turned to Singh.
Sir, it is my opinion that the sabotage effort your friend discovered is part of a much larger operation, and whatever the enemy has in mind, it's happening right now.
Singh shook his head, not his disagreement, but like a drunk man trying to clear away the fog.
Some part of him was still thinking that because they had the guard force ready to keep the station's sensor arrays up, things were under control. That he was prepared for whatever was happening, even as it bloomed out around him.
I understand, he said.
As your chief of security, I recommend that we get you and any other essential personnel in lockdown until the situation is better controlled.
Of course. I'll return to my office.
Might not want to stay that near an obvious target, sir.
I have a secure position prepared.
I'll have a fire team escort you and stay there until we understand better what we're looking at, Overstreet said.
He turned to the older woman and gestured toward Singh.
He needs an escort.
On their way, sir.
Belay that, Singh thought. I'll stay here.
Except that it was a stupid impulse, based in pride. A leader should stand with his team in a time of crisis, but as much as it galled him, Overstreet was that leader in this moment. He would only get in the way. And even so, part of him wanted to remain, to be seen to be in control.
I will expect updates, Singh said. When you need my authorization, I will be waiting.
Thank you, sir.
Overstreet said without missing a beat, then turned away. A moment later, four Marines in power armor stepped in through the main door and saluted.
"Governor Singh, sir."
"You're my escort, then," Singh said with a smile that he hoped looked confident.
"Let's be on our way."
As they walked, Singh consulted his own wrist monitor. There was too much happening, too many individual groups coordinating on the fly to have a complete picture of the situation. The storm was maneuvering, and the Rocinante hadn't yet made an aggressive move. The riot at the detention cells was growing more violent, and the Marine fire team was requesting permission to escalate to lethal countermeasures. And Overstreet's words came back, haunting with their implications.
"My best estimate is that a third of our operating personnel are open to working against us."
The hardest thing was to trust his own people to do their jobs well. But it was what he had to do. He wondered if the High Council suffered the same thing, knowing that all the critical action would be taken by others who were guided by his orders, but in conditions he could only guess at, and in places where his intervention, even if it were possible, could only muddy the waters. It was a subtle and terrible insight. The powerlessness of control. The warning echoed through the station. A man ran through an intersection ahead of him without pausing to look. Singh's legs burned a little from his pace.
"Where are we going?" he asked the head of the fire team.
"We have a hard shelter at the end of this corridor, sir. It's a bit away from the main offices to be a less obvious target, but it has independent environmental controls and..."
The Marine froze in mid-stride. Singh felt a rush of fear, looked down the corridor to see what danger the man was reacting to. There was nothing.
"What's the matter?" he said.
It was only when he got no answer that he realized all the Marines had stopped. Their visors were opaque, their radios silent, their power armor in lockdown. Singh stood, suddenly alone and terribly aware of his own vulnerability. The back of his head itched at the idea that someone might be targeting him right then, and he had no protection. For a moment, he saw Kasich again, dying before him. Was all of this a distraction to pull him away from safety? Hands trembling, he strode fast down the corridor to the first door, a public restroom. He stepped in, made certain he was alone, and locked the door behind him. His heart was beating hard enough to feel the ticking of it in his neck. Leaning against a narrow sink, he pulled his monitor and keyed in his security codes. His Marine lockdown hadn't been triggered. The Marines shouldn't have been disabled. Someone was putting out a false shutdown signal. Overstreet answered his connection request at once.
"My fire team is disabled," he said.
"Yes, sir. I'm seeing the same with all the powered teams. Stay where you are. I am sending a conventional escort to your location."
"What the hell is going on out there? I need a report."
Annoyance flickered across Overstreet's face, gone almost before Singh could register it. The loss of functioning fire teams has let the situation at the detention cells deteriorate.
"I have initial reports that something's happening at the dockmaster's office. I'm waiting for better intelligence on that, but I'm seeing what looks like several ships getting ready for launch. The storm has engaged with the Rocinante, but not conclusively as yet. Now, may I please go do my job instead of talking about it?"
He didn't say it, but Singh heard it anyway.
"I will wait for the second escort," Singh said. "Carry on."
He dropped the connection. In the mirror, he looked small, frightened. He stood, straightened his uniform, and composed himself until his reflection looked more like a man confident in his control of the situation. It was important, when his people came, that he give the right impression. That was all he could do now. Something thumped deep below him. A strike on the station drum, maybe. A sign of the battle going on all around him while he hid in a public toilet. The underground had caught him unprepared. To give them their due, he'd underestimated their coordination and their numbers and their will. He had been told that the belters of the old regime had a culture of violent resistance. After the sabotage of the oxygen tank, he had thought he understood what that meant, but he hadn't appreciated the depth of it until now. Their plan was unfolding right now all around the station. All he could hope was that the one place he knew that he was ahead of them would prove decisive. If disabling the sensor arrays was critical to their plan, he could still bring all the rest of it crashing down.
Chapter 47. Bobby. Bobby's harness consisted of three magnetic locks about the size of her palm, and two bands of woven nylon that looked like they'd been green sometime in their past. Basic safety equipment, standard on any ship, any dock, any station outside the gravity well. Wondering whether they worked was like wondering if her next footstep would sink through the atoms of the deck. "You think these things are going to hold?" she asked. Her radio was set to a broadcast strength so low, a thick T-shirt would have jammed her. Amos, beside her, looked up the long curve of the gathering storm's exterior. His helmet hid his expression, but his tone was fatalistic.
"If it doesn't, this will be a weird day."
The surface of the ship wasn't like anything Bobby had ever seen. Faceted like a gem, without the protrusions of PDC cannons or sensor arrays. The pinks and blues seemed less like the color of the material itself, and more like some kind of refraction. Something that it did to light that was much weirder than selective absorption. The darkness of the slow zone was profound. Her helmet had to enhance everything with what it picked up from the glow of the ring station. It even stretched the edges, pulling ultraviolet and infrared into the visible range just to have more to work with. It was always like this, but waiting, exposed and uncertain, made it seem ominous. While the surface of the ship looked like crystal, it was soft in a way that she wanted to think of as foam. What it really reminded her of was skin. The magnetic locks bound her to it in a rough, uncomfortable cradle, or would once the ship was underway, provided that the magnetic locks held on. The red glow that said they were clamped was solid, except that every now and then she thought she caught a flicker of amber. The other 10 members of the insertion team besides her and Amos were all using the same equipment. Their suits were all low-level environment suits. None of them had better than welder's padding as armor. They looked more like a cleaning crew than a crack military force. It worried her how true that might be, but that was for after the locks held. If the storm pushed off from the dock and left them all floating behind it like a snake's shed skin, it would be up to Alex to solve the problem of the enemy destroyer, and they'd probably all die. There was no upside.
"Really hope these hold," Bobby said.
The encrypted alert came. Bobby tapped her forearm controls. When Alex's voice came through, it had the thick Mariner Valley drawl that meant he was scared shitless, but also a little euphoric on the fear.
This is Alex Kamal of the Rosinante calling out to my friends and family and all ships at sea. We are about to start this rodeo, breaking loose from the docking clamps in 10, 9.
Brace, Bobby said. We don't know how fast this is going to happen.
She took the nylon cords, tracked them in tight, and waited for the gathering storm to leave port. In order to get there, they'd crawled out from the elevator shaft that ran the length of the station from the command and control at the bow down to engineering at the stern. They'd moved quickly, skimming along centimeters above the station. The others had been laughing until Bobby reminded them that low-power radio wasn't radio silence and politely suggested they all shut the fuck up instead of getting the team killed. After that, she'd been alone with the sound of her own breath, the smells of old rubber and someone else's sweat. Alex had been on her right, Amos on her left, and the dock spiked with ships a quarter of a click before them. Past that, just the blackness of the slow zone, and the killing nothingness beyond the gates. The drum had spun beneath them. The scars and damage from the brief battle with the storm still showed in blackened streaks and bright patch foam. Medina had taken more than her fair share of licks in her life, and today wasn't going to be any better. They'd pulled out every trick that any of Saba's underground had up their sleeves, stealing the welding rings, uncrating the hidden caches of weapons, compromising the access shaft that let them through. Ever since the Laconians had come through the gate, smart people familiar with the station had been planning for this moment. Maybe since before that, if some of them were smugglers. As they passed over the last of the drum, Alex split off. He had to make his way almost a third of the way anti-spinward from the storm to reach the Rosinante. She told herself it wasn't the last time she'd see him, as if she knew it were true. Then, with a flick of her fist, she directed the insertion team toward the dark, looming form of the destroyer. The plan was to lure the gathering storm off the station. As soon as its docking clamps were off and no new soldiers could get on, Bobby and Amos would breach the hull and lead an insertion and take the storm off the playing field. Whether they did that by blowing its reactor, sabotaging its controls, or steering it out toward the nothingness between the gates, was going to be a game day call once she was inside. Without better knowledge of the ship's internal workings, improvising was a better option than pretending she could make a solid plan. The secondary objective was to get her people off the storm and safely picked up by one of the fleeing ships. The tertiary objective was to get away herself. Alex reached zero, and Bobby thought she felt a little tremor through the storm as the Rosie blew her clamps and spun out away from the docks, using the body of Medina as cover. Two of her magnetic locks flickered amber, and then safely back to red. It was a day with a lot of ways to die packed in it. Like Alex, she couldn't keep from grinning. Maybe it was a Martian thing. She stayed braced, her feet against the hull, knees bent. The minutes stretched. The blower in her helmet felt cold against her forehead. That meant she was starting to sweat.
"How are you holding together there, Babs?" Amos asked.
The radio made it sound like he was half a click away and whispering.
"I'll be fine once they get this ship out of dock."
"Yeah, not really leaping into action, are they?"
"We were hoping to catch them flat-footed."
"That's true," Amos said.
"Still, maybe they didn't notice,"
one of the others said.
"Or maybe they're waiting for more troops to get on board," Bobby thought.
and the gathering storm surged out to the black, snapping the nylon bands taut. They were on maneuvering thrusters. 15 meters down from them, a blast of superheated steam vented, pushing the destroyer into a fast rotation. It didn't seem to come from any place, as if the thruster were hidden under the weird, knot metal of the hull until they wanted it. Good thing they hadn't set up their camp there, or at least one of them would probably have blasted off the ship and cooked to death already. The storm lurched. The rumble of the thrusters translated itself up their legs. Medina fell away, like someone had dropped it. The drive plume of the storm's main drive flared, and the ship jumped forward, only about a quarter of a G. They weren't going to risk melting Medina to slag. Still, it was a little eerie seeing her shadow stretched long ahead of her on the body of the ship, a reminder that if she fell, she'd die in fire. "Amos," she said, "make us a hole."
"I see you coming after me," Alex's shout sang. "You ain't catching the Rosie, friend. We're just too damn pretty for you."
"Alex, get off this channel," she yelled, then remembered that her signal was intentionally too weak to carry. She shook her head and hoped he wouldn't be too distracting. Amos had the welding kit out, power supply strapped to his side. With two broken ribs, she figured the rig had to hurt like hell, but nothing about his movement betrayed the pain. Her own cracked tailbone wasn't making it any more comfortable either. They'd done themselves a lot of damage getting this far. She had to make sure it didn't make a difference. Pain was just her body telling her something. She could choose to ignore it. Amos held the torch to the hull, and everything went bright. Sparks seemed to stream away behind them, curving down and vanishing against the hull like gravity was pulling them, and not just the turning of the ship. "Weapons ready," she barked, and the others acknowledged. If the destroyer had the double-hulled design that all Martian ships had, cutting their way through here would only be the first step. But it was a critical one. There was damage they could do there. But it was also difficult to defend, and with none of the storm's crew there, tactics like flooding it with hydrogen and oxygen could take out her whole team without risk to the enemy. Tempting as it was, she had to get into the ship proper, and...
"Babs, this is weird as shit."
Amos stood bracing. The cut from the welding torch was a line of brightness in the hull half a meter long. Half a meter long and shrinking fast.
"What have we got? Remember how it looked like the hull could repair itself? It's doing it now, too."
"That going to be a problem?"
"Yeah," Amos said. "I'd say that'll make this hard."
The storm lurched under them. The drive plume brightened below them, and the storm gathered speed. The acceleration pulled the straps taut as the thrust gravity made the nuclear-powered flames of the plume more definitively down. The bowmost of Bobby's magnetic locks flickered amber and slid a few centimeters before it went red again and stopped. The little moment of give shot adrenaline through her body. Her heart was thudding in her ears. Her voice was so calm it sounded like someone else.
"Got any bright ideas?"
"Let me try something," he said and hunkered down.
He cut again, but in a tight curve, not making a hole they could breach through, but something smaller. When he got around it, he punched in, pushing the little core of hull material into the space within the ship. The circle he'd made instantly began closing, but Amos was carving slivers off its edge. He pared the hole wider and wider, even as it fought to narrow. His motions were fast and efficient. He didn't slow down even as the ship bucked and turned under them, the proof of a lifetime's physical labor made into elegance. Bobby knew that if she'd tried this, she'd never have been able to keep up. But with Amos, the hole grew wider.
"Edges are going to be toasty," Amos said. "Nothing I can do about that."
Saba's voice murmured in Bobby's ear.
"Marine fire teams have reached the